Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, April 21st. Another day of pandemic politics over the issues of testing, immigration, and social distancing. The president tweeted last night that he'll temporarily suspend all immigration to the U.S. because so many U.S. citizens are losing their jobs. So far, it's just a tweet. We'll see what the actual policy proposal is, if any, that follows. Three southern states will start reopening their economies. You've heard this, in some cases, without meeting the federal guidelines of 2 weeks of steadily declining caseloads. The mayor of Atlanta can't believe she's being asked by the Georgia governor to reopen close contact businesses like gyms, restaurants, hair salons, and bowling alleys. Here with Chris Cuomo on CNN last night is Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms.
Chris, I have four kids in my house, and no sooner than the governor made his announcement, my 18-year-old, who will be 18 tomorrow, came running into the room to announce to me that the governor said he could leave home. So as a parent, I am concerned, because what I know is that when I look at the data that we receive from our public health department each day, our numbers are going up.
The mayor of Atlanta on CNN last night. It's the intersection of politics, economics, and public health. We'll see if they can really establish social distancing practices at places like bowling alleys and gyms and hair salons and restaurants without actually launching a new pandemic surge. One commentator yesterday said, "Blue America thinks we're in a public health crisis. Red America thinks we're in an economic crisis." Maybe it's not that simply polarized, but it's one way of looking at it. And here's a big question about testing, a political football of a question, but also a very practical concern. To what degree is it the state's responsibility? To what degree the federal government's? And how much does the answer to that question matter if we want to really have enough virus testing and antibody testing to reopen the country without flying blind? Despite some polarized political language that you hear every day, the real answer may be both and. Today, Governor Andrew Cuomo is flying down from New York to meet with President Trump at the White House. Ramping up testing isn't the only issue on their plates, but it is no doubt a central one. And what they say behind closed doors might be more cooperative than what they say to the cameras. Let me play a clip of Cuomo from a few days ago and one from the Trump briefing last night. On Thursday, Cuomo issued an executive order to require all public and private labs in New York to coordinate with the state to prioritize COVID-19 diagnostic testing. That's action at the state level to force a focus by the labs that wasn't taking place. But some things are not in his control. Swabs to take the tests are running out, and Cuomo said they need more testing chemicals called reagents, which need to be imported from China in many cases. So then he said this.
I can do what I can do on the state side, and I will. And I'm going to issue an executive order that says the Department of Health will be coordinating those private sector labs, which are private sector companies, but they're licensed by the state of New York. They're permitted by the state of New York. And we need them to step up and work together. But the federal government cannot wipe their hands of this and say, oh, the states are responsible for testing. We cannot do it. We cannot do it without federal help. I'm willing to do what I can do and more, but I'm telling you, I don't do China relations. I don't do international supply chain, and that's where the federal government can help.
So Cuomo is doing things and asking for things. From Trump's end, he seems to now be feeling the pressure from declining poll numbers after saying that tests are up to the states. At last night's briefing, he made a big push to show that the federal government is playing a lead role, not that it doesn't have to. For example, here is Brad Smith, director of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Innovation Center, at last night's briefing.
one company located in the Northeast. We're going to be using Title III of the DPA to help them build four new production lines. They are currently the largest swab producer in the country, and this will help them ramp up their production tremendously to over 20 million additional swabs a month. A second company located in Ohio is currently the largest Q-tip maker in the country. We're helping them convert their line from making Q-tips into making swabs. They are actually ramping up production starting this week of swabs and will be ramping up to over 10 million per month. So in total, that's over 30 million new swabs that will be coming just over the next handful of weeks.
The federal government is starting to talk about forcing things through the DPA that he referred there, the Defense Production Act, and other means at the level of tens of millions of pieces. And Brad Smith went on. Here's another example.
The collection tubes, we've been partnering with Oak Ridge National Lab, a Department of Energy lab based in Tennessee. They have very unique and sophisticated injection molding manufacturing capability, and they are in the process of ramping that up to create collection tubes, and they will be ramping up to over 40 million collection tubes a month here over the next several weeks.
So maybe, just maybe, the president is doing re-election politics both by accusing the governors of failing to step up themselves, but also by stepping up himself with the federal effort so that he can say he did. Let's talk about the role of both the states and the federal government. With me now, Yale professor of both epidemiology and law, Greg Gonsalves. He's also co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership there, co-director of the Collaboration for Research, Integrity, and Transparency, too. Those are good things. And a contributor to The Nation magazine. His latest article in The Nation is called Testing, Testing, 1, 2, 3, Testing. He says we can currently test 1 million people a week. It needs to be 2 to 3 million. Professor Gonsalves, we appreciate you making the time today. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Glad to be here.
I imagine you're not happy with the reopening they're about to try in Georgia, but given the current shortage of available testing, how might they best deploy the testing they have in conjunction with the opening of restaurants and hair salons and gyms, et cetera, that they're apparently about to try?
As I said, as I've said in the article and I've been saying, we have about 1 million tests that are being deployed a week in the United States, right? And just think about what that means in terms of the state capacity, which is far, far, far less. You know, maybe we need 2 to 3 million on a weekly basis to get started, but probably tens of millions when we get down to it and we start to really open up the economy. You know, maybe they should be testing in these restaurants and gyms and hair salons and places where they're putting people in close quarters, because what they're going to find is infections among people who have had mild disease or have had no symptoms at all, and maybe they'll change their tune once they see what they've unleashed on the state of Georgia.
You wrote in The Nation that colleagues of yours at Yale have recently suggested prioritizing hotspots for testing, like apartment buildings, nursing homes, and businesses that are open like Amazon hubs and grocery stores, while also doing random testing. Now we know it's going to be many more kinds of businesses in Atlanta. Can you explain what that two-pronged approach would accomplish if it works and how it might be applied in an experimental reopening like Atlanta is about to undertake?
Well, the reason you target apartment buildings, nursing homes, basically people where people are clustered together or in constant contact, like grocery stores or pharmacies, for instance, is because that's where you'll see most of the person-to-person contact and possible person-to-person transmission. So you want to see what's going on there. Remember, these tests are like a flashlight shining into the dark, saying, here's an infection, here's an infection, here's another infection. But we have an idea that we may find more clusters of infection in apartment buildings or in other sort of close quarter settings. We don't know exactly where there are hot spots in Georgia or Atlanta or any place across the country. And that's why you're going to think of doing random testing to sort of just sort of cover the field and get a sense of what the entire sort of prevalence or level of infection is across the state. But again, you know, it's with a very small number of tests for each state at this current moment, there's not an ability to do either the targeted or the random testing in any sort of comprehensive way. So, you know, you're lighting a match and trying to light up the state of Georgia so you can see what's going on. That's the kind of kind of situation we're in.
To be transparent for the listeners, Professor, I see you're a big critic of President Trump. Your Twitter makes that extremely clear. But how much for you is the answer to whose responsibility testing is both and? That is, the states have a role, like Cuomo ordering labs in New York to prioritize COVID testing, which I guess they weren't doing for whatever reason, and the feds producing tens of millions of swabs and other things, like we heard from the federal official Brad Smith in those clips. How much is it both and how do you see the ideal working relationship if they're actually doing it without kicking each other to the side for politics?
So let's be bipartisan about this. We've had a disinvestment in public health over 10 years. The CDC's budget has dropped by about 10%. I think close to 55,000 public health workers across state and local jurisdictions have been let go over the past 10 years. So we've basically dug ourselves a hole in public health over the past 10 years, both on the state, local, and federal level in terms of our investment. So that's blame to go around. Look, the governors can start to recruit people to do contact tracing and testing, like Governor Charlie Baker, a Republican, is now doing in Massachusetts, asking partners in health to hire 1,000 people to go out and test and trace. But there's certain things the federal government can only do, and this is the production of the swabs, as you heard in your previous segment, production of the reagents, the test tubes. Congress, which is split between a Democratic House and a Republican Senate, needs to appropriate money so that we can scale up on the state level. Because remember, states can't run deficits. So what's going to happen is that they're going to need money from the federal government to hire people to do this contact tracing and testing. So I may be a critic of President Trump. I've been an AIDS activist for 40 years, and I've criticized President Clinton, President Obama, President Bush, and President Trump. So I'm an equal opportunity critic at this point. But the point is that there's responsibilities that are specifically the job of the federal government in terms of procurement and industrial production, which a state really can't do, and a congressional responsibility to appropriate the money so that states can hire people to do the work that needs to be done. So there's blame to go around.
Go ahead. Do you get why Cuomo at the state level would have to order labs to prioritize COVID-19 diagnostic testing? Why wouldn't the labs have been doing that anyway?
Well, there are a lot of private labs in New York State and my state of Connecticut. Quest, when you go to the doctor and you get your blood drawn, it's usually not being done by a public health laboratory. It's probably being done by a for-profit laboratory. So there's a lot of private lab capacity across. And they're not under the jurisdiction of the governor or the mayor. And so unless there's some special dispensation that's put out there, like the Governor Cuomo is doing now, they have nothing to compel them to sort of get with the program. And I think, this is what governors are going to need to be doing across New York and the rest of the region and the rest of the country, trying to mobilize all their public and private sector labs to sort of scale up capacity as the federal government starts to let the commodities flow and the resources flow to let them scale up.
I heard Dr. Birx, say in one of the White House briefings that the reimbursement rate for COVID-19 tests was only about $50, on which the labs were losing money. So they upped it to $100 so they could at least break even or make a little in these private businesses. And that might have been one impediment. And I'm curious if, based on last night's White House briefing, like those clips we played of Brad Smith talking about tens of millions of swabs a month and the other things, how much do you think that Trump, craven as his political approach might be, is starting to do what Washington does need to do?
So look, there's been bipartisan consensus about what we need to do, from the right, from people like Scott Gottlieb, his former FDA commissioner. Zeke Emanuel used to be in the Obama White House. So I think there's a large consensus in D.C. about what needs to be done. I think the civil servants like Ambassador Birx and Dr. Fauci understand what needs to be done, too. The big problem right now is that states that are insisting on reopening before we have this scale up are flying blind, right, into a firestorm of potential resurgence of COVID-19 and coronavirus. So I'm very happy to hear that they're scaling up. But there needs to be another announcement that says, you know what, we're going to give you the social and economic support to let you ride out the storm until we get these tests online. You know, you had suggested that this is about the economy versus public health. You know, Austin Goolsbee, who was President Obama's chair of the Council on Economic Advisors, said, you know what, the first rule of virus economics is it's to stop the virus. So I don't think there's any daylight between what the economists and the epidemiologists think. I think we just need to make political decisions that both follow the economic advice and the epidemiological advice to protect our economy and to protect our people from death and sickness from COVID-19.
We have some Atlanta folks checking in. Let's take some phone calls on this reopening of businesses that's going to start on Friday. Brooks in Atlanta, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling in. Hiya, Brooks.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm born and raised in Atlanta. I live here now. Lived here most of my life, but I've also lived in New York a couple of times, so I listened to you forever. So thanks for the question. I mean, people in Atlanta are really disheartened and honestly infuriated by this. It's felt like people have been really working hard to flatten the curve, and it's been a struggle, clearly. And, you know, I'm privileged that I'm able to keep working from home, but there are a lot of people trying to support everybody who can't. And, you know, we saw numbers, our infection rate, our infection numbers and cases, and I think deaths kept going up through yesterday. So the idea that we've gotten the curve under control is a joke. And so what a lot of people are concerned with is that what this, and I'd love to hear your guests take on this if they know, is that what this is actually going to do, these businesses that can be opened, is that it's going to make those businesses and their employees now ineligible for benefits because they don't have COVID-19 as a reason to be out of work. And so they're going to be forced to choose, you know, to go back to work and either risk their lives and help and risk other people's lives or not get those benefits and not be able to feed their kids. So that's the big thing here. And then I'll also tell you, a lot of people are very aware and upset about the fact that we could have had another governor who would have handled this very differently had it not been for Kemp overseeing his own election and exercising a lot of voter suppression.
Last name Abrams, first name Stacy, but she's not the governor. Brooks, let me just ask you a quick follow-up question, and then Professor Gonsalves will, I'm sure, happily answer yours. What do you make of it politically? Why is Governor Kemp ordering this if it's causing tremendous amounts of fear in the city of Atlanta?
I think there are a few dynamics. I think one, there's, you know, when you talk about Atlanta and Georgia, there's a dynamic between Georgia and the rest of the state. There's, and race has a lot to do with it, but the rest of the state is often very skeptical of Atlanta. Kemp has been a huge supporter of Trump, and just from seeing him on the campaign trail, I think he buys into a lot of this Trump rhetoric. And we know he has not paid attention to the information, right? He's the one that just a couple weeks ago said he just found out for the first time that it could be spread asymptomatically. Right. And I was kind of shocked his top health advisor in the article, one of the articles that came out about yesterday, said social distancing has worked, as if it's just done and we fixed it. So I don't know if he's being blind to the information or if he's getting bad information.
Right, or pandering to the rest of the state. Professor Gonsalves, what would you say to Brooks?
Well, I mean, I think Brooks has it pretty right on target. You know, the state of the epidemic in Georgia and Atlanta is at a critical point, and opening up the places that are the very sites of sort of constant human contact are going to risk sort of creating a firestorm of new infections. You know, the other point he made is very important. You know, this isn't an abstract conversation. People who work in these places are going to be told that they need to go back to work because there is no longer any statewide distancing order on these businesses. And so if they decide that they don't want to go back to work for the basis of their health, are their jobs secure? You know, if they get sick, do they have the right to sue their employers for putting them in danger? There's an article in Roll Call magazine in Capitol Hill, I think 2 days ago, which was talking about as workers face virus risks, employers seek liability limits. U.S. Chamber of Commerce, for instance, is asking for companies to be indemnified against COVID transmission in the workplace. So, you know, Governor Kemp may be sort of endangering the public by relaxing social distancing orders, but he's also sort of doing the business, the bidding of businesses in his state who are prioritizing their bottom line over the health of, and mm-hmm. the well-being of their workers.
Lori in Astoria, whose father lives in Atlanta. Lori, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. I live in Astoria now, but I'm from Atlanta, and my father's down there. I talked to him last night. He's 83 years old, and he just can't wait to go get a haircut. And I told him, I said, whoa, now, that's not a good idea. Do you really? I don't think you should take that risk. I think I walked him back from it, but I'm really, really worried about him. He's one of those stubborn gentlemen who, like, is going to the grocery store, you know? And I'm very worried about him. I'm worried that also that Georgia and Atlanta especially, is going to be a guinea pig for us. Like, we're just going to sit back and see what rolls out there in the next 3 weeks.
Yeah, definitely.
And see what happens. But, you know, there are all these people I love down there, and I don't like to see them being used this way.
Lori, thank you so much. And Professor Gonsalves, how can they, if her father goes back to the barbershop, which is going to reopen if the proprietor chooses to take that permission, how can they safely give a haircut? You know, there are no scissors or razors that I know of that have 6-foot handles. So how can they do it? Eventually, people are going to tiptoe back in with some risk. It may be extremely premature in Atlanta, we'll see, but how can they do it?
I mean, you jokingly said there's no scissors with 6-foot, you know, handles. The point is you can't, right? The reason that barbershops, restaurants, and these other sort of high contact businesses were asked to close is because it's almost, you can't social distance, right? In these situations, you can't prevent infection when you're right up there, you know, basically breathing over somebody else. And you as a barber or a hairstylist have, you know, seen 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 customers that day. And so, you know, your caller said this is a bit of an experiment that's happening in Georgia. And sadly, you know, we're going to see what happens when you prematurely open up for business in the midst of a sort of fulminant epidemic in the state. And so I worry for your caller's elderly father. I have an elderly here in New York State. I think, you know, we're going to see what happens. I don't think there's much that's going to be done to convince Governor Kemp to change his ways. But these reopenings fly in the face of both economic and epidemiological advice.
Let me play a clip of Anthony Fauci from a few days ago at a White House briefing. We played this yesterday, but I would like to hear your take. He talks here about the scenario of unlimited, even daily testing of people, and asks whether that's necessary in order to go back to normal activities like getting haircuts. Listen.
The part about that I think is often misunderstood is that if you get a test today, like I did today, it's negative. If you get a test today, that does not mean that tomorrow or the next day or the next day or the next day, as you get exposed, perhaps from someone who may not even know they're infected, that means that I'm negative, which means if you take that to its extreme, in order to be really sure, you would almost have to test somebody either every day or every other day or every week or what it is to be absolutely certain. That's an issue.
That's an issue. But is that, Professor Gonsalves, where we need to be? We test ourselves for COVID every morning like we brush our teeth?
No, this is the point. You know, by doing a slow reentry out of social distancing, what we do is we test widely to try to figure out where the infections are in the state of Georgia or in the state of New York or the state of Montana. And then we isolate those individuals, talk to their contacts, test them, and isolate them as well. The point is that with testing, we're trying to sort of pull people out of the sort of social world who are at risk of disease and try to snuff it out that way. Testing everybody every day is not a viable solution. But, you know, the strategy I've spoken to you about, testing tracing and isolating. Mm-hmm. It's been done for over 150 years in public health and has worked against smallpox and other diseases. And so I'm not asking for anything newfangled or fancy. We can do this, and we can confront the coronavirus epidemic in our communities, but we've got to do it the right way and follow the evidence.
Yale professor of both epidemiology and law, Greg Gonzalez. He's also co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership there and a contributor to The Nation, where his latest article is called Testing, Testing, 1, 2, 3, Testing. Thank you so much for coming on today. It's been really informative. I appreciate it a lot.
Anytime, Brian. Thanks.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast. Under the circumstances in our country right now, we'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.